Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 13 of Three Men in a Boat.
The Georgian Dragon at Wargrave boasts a sign painted on the one side by Leslie, R.A., and on the other by Hodgson of that ilk. Leslie had depicted the fight. Hodgson had imagined the scene after the fight. George, the work done, enjoying himself. Day, the author of Sanford and Merton, lived and, more credit to the place still, was killed at Wargrave. In the church is a memorial to Mrs. Sarah Hill, who bequeathed £1 annually to be divided at Easter between two boys and two girls who have never been undutiful to their parents, who have never been known to swear or to tell untruths, to steal or to break windows. Fancy giving up all that for 5 shillings a year. It is not worth it. It is rumored in the town that once, many years ago, a boy appeared who really never had done these things, or, at all events, which was all that was required or could be expected, had never been known to do them, and thus won the crown of glory. He was exhibited for 3 weeks afterwards in the town hall under a glass case. What has become of the money since, no one knows. They say it is always handed over to the nearest waxwork show. Shiplake is a pretty village, but it cannot be seen from the river, being upon the hill. Tennyson was married in Shiplake Church. The river, up to Sonning, winds in and out through many islands, and it is very placid, hushed, and lonely. Few folk, except at twilight, a pair or two of rustic lovers, walk along its banks. Ari and Lord Fitznoodle have been left behind at Henley, and dismal, dirty reading has not yet reached. It is a part of the river in which to dream of bygone days and vanished forms and faces, and the things that might have been, but are not, confound them. We got out at Sonning and went for a walk round the village. It is the most fairy-like little nook on the whole river. It is more like a stage village than one built of bricks and mortar. Every house is smothered in roses, and now, in early June, they were bursting forth in clouds of dainty splendor. If you stop at Sonning, put up at the Bull, behind the church. It is a veritable picture of an old country inn, with green square courtyard in front, where, on seats beneath the trees, the old men group and gossip over the village politics, with low, quaint rooms and latticed windows and awkward stairs and winding passages. We roamed about Sweet Sonning for an hour or so, and then, it being too late to push on past reading, we decided to go back to one of the Shiplake Islands and put up there for the night. It was still early when we got settled, and George said that, as we had plenty of time, it would be a splendid opportunity to try a good slap-up supper. He said he would show us what could be done up the river in the way of cooking, and suggested that, with the vegetables and the remains of the cold meat and general odds and ends, we should make an Irish stew. It seemed a fascinating idea. George gathered wood and made a fire, and Harris and I started to peel the potatoes. I should never have thought that peeling potatoes was such an undertaking. The job turned out to be the biggest thing of its kind that I had ever been in. We began cheerfully, one might almost say skittishly, but our lightheartedness was gone by the time the first potato was finished. The more we peeled, the more peel there seemed to be left on. By the time we got all the peel off and all the eyes out, there was no potato left, at least none worth speaking of. George came and had a look at it. It was about the size of a peanut, he said. Oh, that won't do. You're wasting them. You must scrape them. So we scraped them, and that was harder work than peeling. They are such an extraordinary shape. Potatoes, all bumps and warts and hollows. We worked steadily for 5 and 20 minutes and did 4 potatoes. Then we struck. We said we would require the rest of the evening for scraping ourselves. I never saw such a thing as potato scraping for making a fellow into a mess. It seemed difficult to believe that the potato scrapings in which Harris and I stood, half smothered, could have come off of 4 potatoes. It showed you what can be done with economy and care. George said it was absurd to have only 4 potatoes in an Irish stew, so we washed 6 or so more and put them in without peeling. We also put in a cabbage and about 1/2 peck of peas. George stirred it all up, and then he said that there seemed to be a lot of room to spare, so we overhauled both the hampers and picked out all the odds and ends and the remnants and added them to the stew. There were 1/2 pie and a bit of cold boiled meat left, and we put them in. Then George found 1/2 tin of potted salmon, and he emptied that into the pot. He said that the advantage of Irish stew, you could get rid of a lot of things. I fished out 2 eggs that had not cracked and put those in. George said they would thicken the gravy. I forget the other ingredients, but I know nothing was wasted, and I remember that, towards the end, Montmorency, who had evinced great interest in the proceedings throughout, strolled away with an earnest and thoughtful air, reappearing 1 few minutes afterward with a dead water rat in his mouth, which he evidently wished to present as his contribution to the dinner. Whether in a sarcastic spirit or with a genuine desire to assist, I cannot say. We had a discussion as to whether the rat should go in or not. Harris said that he thought it would be all right, mixed up with the other things, and that every little thing helped. But George stood up for precedent. He said he had never heard of water rats in Irish stew, and he would rather be on the safe side and not try to experiment. Harris said, "If you never try a new thing, how can you tell what it's like? It's men such as you that hamper the world's progress. Think of the man who first tried German sausage." It was a great success, that Irish stew. I don't think I ever enjoyed a meal more. There was something so fresh and piquant about it. One's palate gets so tired of the old hackneyed things. Here was a dish with new flavor, with a taste like nothing else on earth. And it was nourishing, too. As George said, there was good stuff in it. The peas and potatoes might have been a bit softer, but we all had good teeth, so that did not matter much. And as for the gravy, it was a poem, a little too rich, perhaps for a weak stomach, but nutritious. We finished up with tea and cherry tart. Montmorency had a fight with the kettle during the tea time and came off a poor second. Throughout the trip, he had manifested a great curiosity concerning the kettle. He would sit and watch it as it boiled with a puzzled expression and would try to rouse it every now and then by growling at it. When it began to sputter and steam, he regarded it as a challenge and would want to fight it, only at that precise moment, someone would always dash up and bear off his prey before he could get at it. Today he determined he would be beforehand. At the first sound the kettle made, he rose, growling, and advanced towards it in a threatening attitude. It was only a little kettle, but it was full of pluck, and it up and spit at him. "Ah, would ye?" growled Montmorency, showing his teeth. "I'll teach ye to cheek a hard-working, respectable dog, ye miserable, long-nosed, dirty-looking scoundrel, ye. Come on!" And he rushed at that poor little kettle and seized it by the spout. Then across the evening stillness broke a blood-curdling yelp, and Montmorency left the boat and did a constitutional 3 times round the island at the rate of 35 miles an hour, stopping every now and then to bury his nose in a bit of cool mud. From that day, Montmorency regarded the kettle with a mixture of awe, suspicion, and hate. Whenever he saw it, he would growl and back at a rapid rate with his tail shut down, and the moment it was put upon the stove, he would promptly climb out of the boat and sit on the bank till the whole tea business was over. George got out his banjo after supper and wanted to play it, but Harris objected. He said he had got a headache and did not feel strong enough to stand it. George thought the music might do him good and said music often soothes the nerves and takes away a headache. And he twanged 2 or 3 notes just to show Harris what it was like. Harris said he would rather have the headache. George has never learned to play a banjo to this day. He has had too much all-round discouragement to meet. He tried on 2 or 3 evenings while we were up the river to get a little practice, but it was never a success. Harris's language used to be enough to unnerve any man, added to which Montmorency would sit and howl steadily right through the performance. It was not giving the man a fair chance. "What's he want to howl like that for when I'm playing?" George would exclaim indignantly, while taking aim at him with a boot. "What do you want to play like that for when he is howling?" Harris would retort, catching the boot. "You let him alone. He can't help howling. He got a musical ear, and your playing makes him howl." So George determined to postpone study of the banjo until he reached home, but he did not get much opportunity even there. Mrs. P. used to come up and say she was very sorry for herself. She liked to hear him, but the lady upstairs was in a very delicate state, and the doctor was afraid it might injure the child. Then George tried taking it out with him late at night and practicing round the square, but the inhabitants complained to the police about it, and a watch was set for him one night, and he was captured. The evidence against him was very clear, and he was bound over to keep the peace for 6 months. He seemed to lose heart in the business after that. He did make 1 or 2 feeble efforts to take up the work again when the 6 months had elapsed, but there was always the same coldness, the same want of sympathy on the part of the world to fight against. And after a while, he despaired altogether and advertised the instrument for sale at a great sacrifice, owner having no further use for same, and took to learning card tricks instead. It must be disheartening work learning a musical instrument. You would think that society, for its own sake, would do all it could to assist a man to acquire the art of playing a musical instrument, but it doesn't. I know a young fellow once who was studying to play the bagpipes, and you would be surprised at the amount of opposition he had to contend with. Why, not even from the members of his own family did he receive what you could call active encouragement. His father was dead set against the business from the beginning and spoke quite unfeelingly on the subject. My friend used to get up early in the morning to practice, but he had to give that up because of his sister. She was somewhat religiously inclined, and she said it seemed such an awful thing to begin the day like that. So he sat up at night instead and played after the family had gone to bed. But that did not do, as it got the house such a bad name. People, going home late, would stop outside to listen and then put it about all over town the next morning that a fearful murder had been committed at Mr. Jefferson's the night before, and would describe how they had heard the victim's shriek and the brutal oaths and the curses of the murderer, followed by the prayer for mercy and the last dying gurgle of the corpse. So they let him practice in the daytime, in the back kitchen, with all the doors shut, but his most successful passages could generally be heard in the sitting room, in spite of these precautions, and would affect his mother almost to tears. She said it put her in mind of her poor father. He had been swallowed by a shark, poor man, while bathing off the coast of New Guinea. Where the connection came in, she could not explain. Then they knocked up a little place for him at the bottom of the garden, about a quarter of a mile from the house, and made him take the machine down there when he wanted to work it. And sometimes a visitor would come to the house who knew nothing of the matter, and they would forget to tell him all about it, and caution him, and he would go out for a stroll round the garden, and suddenly get within earshot of those bagpipes, without being prepared for it or knowing what it was. If he were a man of strong mind, it only gave him fits, but a person of mere average intellect, it usually sent mad. There is, it must be confessed, something very sad about the early efforts of an amateur in bagpipes. I have felt it myself when listening to my young friend. They appear to be a trying instrument to perform upon. You have to get enough breath for the whole tune before you start, at least. So I gathered from watching Jefferson. He would begin magnificently with a wild, full, come-to-the-battle sort of note that quite roused you up. But he would get more and more pianissimo as he went on, and the last verse generally collapsed in the middle with a sputter and a hiss. You want to be in good health to play the bagpipes. Young Jefferson only learnt to play one tune on those bagpipes, but I never heard any complaints about the insufficiency of his repertoire, none whatsoever. This tune was, "The Campbells are coming, hooray, hooray," so he said, though his father always held that it was "The Bluebells of Scotland." Nobody seemed quite sure what it was exactly, but they all agreed that it sounded Scotch. Strangers were allowed 3 guesses. Most of them guessed a different tune each time. Harris was disagreeable after supper. I think it must have been the stew that had upset him. He is not used to high living, so George and I left him in the boat and settled to go for a mooch around Henley. He said we should have a glass of whiskey and a pipe and fix things up for the night. We were to shout when we returned, and he would row over from the island and fetch us. "Don't go to sleep, old man," we said as we started. "Not much fear of that while this stew's on," he grunted as he pulled back to the island. Henley was getting ready for the regatta and was full of bustle. We met a goodish number of men we knew about the town, and in their pleasant company the time slipped by somewhat quickly, so that it was nearly 11 o'clock before we set off on our 4-mile walk home. We had learned to call our little craft by this time. It was a dismal night, coldish with thin rain falling, and as we trudged through the dark, silent fields, talking low to each other and wondering if we were going right or not, we thought of the cozy boat, with the bright light streaming through the tight-drawn canvas, of Harris and Montmorency and the whiskey, and wished that we were there. We conjured up the picture of ourselves inside, tired and a little hungry, of the gloomy river and the shapeless trees, and, like a giant glowworm underneath them, our dear old boat, so warm and snug and cheerful. We could see ourselves at supper there, pecking away at cold meat and passing each other chunks of bread. We could hear the cheery clatter of our knives and the laughing voices, filling all the space and overflowing through the opening out into the night, and we hurried on to realize the vision. We struck the towpath at length, and that made us happy, because prior to this we had not been sure whether we were walking towards the river or away from it. And when you are tired and want to go to bed, uncertainties like that worry you. We passed Ship Lake as the clock was striking the 11:45, and then George said thoughtfully, "You don't happen to remember which of the islands it was, do you?" "No," I replied, beginning to grow thoughtful too. "I don't. How many are there?" "Only 4," answered George. "It will be all right if he's awake." "And if not?" I queried, but we dismissed that train of thought. We shouted when we came opposite the first island, but there was no response, so we went on to the second, and tried there, and obtained the same result. "Oh, I remember now," said George, "it was the third one," and we ran on hopefully to the third one and hallooed. No answer. The case was becoming serious. It was now past midnight. The hotels at Ship Lake and Henley would be crammed, and we could not go around knocking up cottagers and householders in the middle of the night to know if they let apartments. George suggested walking back to Henley and assaulting a policeman, and so getting a night's lodging in the station house. But then there was the thought, suppose he only hits us back and refuses to lock us up? We could not pass the whole night fighting policemen. Besides, we did not want to overdo the thing and get 6 months. We despairingly tried what seemed in the darkness to be the fourth island, but met with no better success. The rain was coming down fast, and evidently meant to last. We were wet to the skin and cold and miserable. We began to wonder whether there were only 4 islands or more, or whether we were near the islands at all, or whether we are anywhere within a mile of where we ought to be, or in the wrong part of the river altogether. Everything looked so strange and different in the darkness. We began to understand the suffering of the babes in the woods. Just when we had given up all hope, yes, I know that is always the time that things do happen in novels and tales, but I can't help it. I resolved, when I began to write this book, that I would be strictly truthful in all these things, and so I will be, even if I have to employ hackneyed phrases for the purpose. It was just when we had given up all hope, and I must therefore say so. Just when we had given up all hope, then, I suddenly caught sight, a little way below us, of a strange, weird sort of glimmering flickering among the trees on the opposite bank. For an instant I thought of ghosts. It was such a shadowy, mysterious light. The next moment it flashed across me that it was our boat, and I set up such a yell across the water that made the night seem to shake in its bed. We waited breathless for a minute, and then, oh! Divine music of the darkness! We heard the answering bark of Montmorency. We shouted back loud enough to wake the 7 sleepers. I never could understand myself why it should take more noise to wake up 7 sleepers than 1, and after what seemed like an hour, but was really, I suppose, about 5 minutes, we saw the lighted boat creeping slowly over the blackness, and heard Harris's sleepy voice asking where we were. There was an unaccountable strangeness about Harris. It was something more than mere ordinary tiredness. He pulled the boat against a part of the bank from which it was quite impossible for us to get into it, and immediately went to sleep. It took us an immense amount of screaming and roaring to wake him up again and to put some sense into him, but we succeeded at last and got safely on board. Harris had a sad expression on him, so we noticed, when we got into the boat. He gave you the idea of a man who had been through trouble. We asked him if anything had happened, and he said, "Swans." It seemed we had moored close to a swan's nest, and soon after George and I had gone, the female swan came back and kicked up a row about it. Harris had chivied her off, and she had gone away and fetched up her old man. Harris said he had had quite a fight with these two swans, but courage and skill had prevailed in the end, and he had defeated them. Half an hour afterwards, they returned with 18 other swans. It must have been a fearful battle, so far as we could understand Harris's account of it. The swans had tried to drag him and Montmorency out of the boat and drowned them, and he had defended himself like a hero for 4 hours and had killed the lot, and they had all paddled away to die. "How many swans did you say there were?" asked George.
32, replied Harris sleepily.
"You said 18 just now," said George.
"No, I didn't," grunted Harris. "I said 12. Think I can't count?"
What were the real facts about these swans, we never found out. We questioned Harris on the subject in the morning, and he said, "What swans?" and seemed to think that George and I had been dreaming.
You have been listening to episode 13 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 14 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.
High in the hills, down in the dales, happy and fancy free. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along, down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along, down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortunes of fame. He never seems to hurry, but he gets there just the same. Kingdoms may come, kingdoms may go, whatever the end may be. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along.